Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Archer's Castle by Martin Archer, narrated by Sean Grindell. Preface. People on the little Falmouth Quay in the fishing boats tied along it were standing up and looking as more and more of our galleys came into Falmouth Harbour. It's no wonder they were. That was Harold's galley in front, and he was leading in a long string of our galleys. And right behind them was one of our two cogs, under its Sergeant Captain Martin, the archer from Yorkshire. Of our 21 galleys and two single-masted cargo cogs which sailed from Malta, all but one of our galleys were now entering Falmouth's harbour. The missing galley somehow disappeared, just as did two of our prizes from Tunis. We were a strong force, even without our missing galleys and cogs, and that's for sure. As of today, we have 20 galleys and two cargo cogs here in Falmouth Harbour, with 1,192 men, including 10 of the original 192 archers who set out from Windsor 7 years ago to go crusading with King Richard. Those were the numbers, of course, if none of our men have run since we last counted them before we left Malta. One of the cogs had an interesting cargo we don't fully understand. The cog Albert and his crew cut out when we raided the harbour at Tunis had a number of little wooden chests containing balls and bricks of some kind of smelly flower paste. My priestly brother Thomas thinks the paste is the same apothecary's compound the poxed captain was being fed when we bought our first boats of him. The two galleys and the cog we bought were the coins we found in the chests we took from the Bishop of Damascus after Thomas killed the murdering bastard. It probably is the same, because he's usually right, my brother Thomas is, because he knows so much, being as he memorized some of the Bible and read all 9 of the parchment books in the monastery before he left it to rescue me from being a serf and take me crusading with the untrustworthy Norman prince who became our king. The paste is very interesting. It takes the pain away from wounds if you eat it. At least it did for poor Peter when he got his hand sliced, and it rotted so bad he died, despite the barber bleeding him. Worth its weight in gold to wounded soldiers and sailors, isn't it? I wonder where the Moors got the paste. Thomas thinks we should ask the Saracens where they were getting it next time we catch one. He thinks we could earn a lot of gold Byzant coins selling it, coins we will surely need if we are to carry out our plan to advance my son. Chapter 1. We reach England. We spent much too much time trying to get what was left of the archers back to England, and dreaming about all the big things we'll do for little George when we finally got him here, my brother Thomas suggested. Aye, and not enough time thinking of practical things, like where my son will spend the winter, and how we'll find food and warm clothes for him and our men. My brother Thomas and I were standing on the bank of the River Fowl. And those were my priestly brother's comments and my reaction to the activity we were watching on the river, and the shouting and the cursing we could hear coming from the galleys and cogs out on the river. Our cogs were trying to make their way upstream against the river's current, and the kindest thing that can be said about the situation is that things weren't going very well at the moment. "They'll come up further if we unload them," Thomas mused. "Aye, but not by much, goddammit," was my frustrated response.
"Maybe we're trying to find a place to camp on the wrong river," Thomas suggested. "There are other rivers in England, you know."
Thomas was right, of course. But we're here for a good reason, and we're doing the best we can. At the moment, we were using a couple of our galleys in an effort to pull our two heavily loaded cogs up the River Fowl, from the estuary at its mouth. What we were trying to do was get them as far up the river as they could go before they touched bottom and could go no further, which was turning out to be not very far at all. The galleys themselves, of course, could be rowed further upstream than the cogs because they have flatter bottoms and they aren't weighed down with a high mast and the heavy cargoes the cogs are carrying. The weapons and Saracen iron we took from Acre and the sacks of corn and amphorae of olive oil they are carrying. The cogs' cargoes are important. We need the weapons to defend ourselves, and the corn to make the bread and brew the ale we drink to break our fast when the sun arrives each morning.
my brother Thomas and I were standing not far from the edge of the river, on the side of a gentle hill that runs down to the river. From here, we could see and hear the activity on the cogs and the galleys pulling them. Our sailing sergeant, Harold Lewis, the former master of a London cog and galley slave we bought and freed when we bought our first boats from their poxed owner, was obviously chivvying them along and dissatisfied with the results. Every so often we could hear his curses and orders all the way up here on the riverbank. Looking down the river, past our boats, we could see the roofs of the hovels in the little fishing village of Falmouth. They were off there in the distance at the mouth of the river, where the harbour begins. It was harvest time, and ever since we got here, the local serfs and churls have been working in the fields around us from dawn to dusk. Not that they'll get much for all their efforts. What with the land being so poor, even the Romans didn't build a road to Cornwall. And it's hard work the serfs are doing, as I damn well know. I used to be one of them before my mum died, and Thomas came back from the monastery to learn me to scribe and sum, and take me away to go crusading with the king. We're here because we are trying to kill two birds with one arrow. Get to Lord Edmund's wife, so we can tell her he's dead by the Saracens, and find a place where we can establish a winter camp, and protect our boats and coins whilst we recruit and train more archers. We need more men who know how to use a longbow, and are trained to fight aboard boats, so we can take our galleys back out to the Holy Land, and earn coins by taking Moorish boats as prizes, and carrying refugees and pilgrims and such from port to port. "Well, your lordship?" Thomas inquired with a smile and a twinkle in his eye. "What are you going to do now?"
"I don't know, but look sharp, priestly brother. Here comes trouble."
Coming towards us were a couple of horsemen. We stood quietly and watched as they rode up. Neither looked very threatening, though one was clearly a knight, and wearing an outer shirt of chainmail armour similar to the one I always wear under my long baggy-sleeved tunic, and Thomas wears under his priest's robe. Neither of them was wearing a helmet or carrying a drawn sword, so we didn't draw our swords or string the bows we always carry. The knight was an older, white-haired man with a genial smile and a big, bushy beard. He held up his hand in a friendly greeting as he approached.
"Hello, hello,"
the knight said with a distinctly Norman accent as he swung himself off his horse and dismounted with his hand held out and a friendly smile on his face.
"I'm Percy, Sir Percy, actually, the Earl of Cornwall Sheriff for Falmouth."
"Hello, Sir Percy," I said as I took his hand and smiled back and named myself. "I'm William, captain of the company of archers who are trying to get their galleys up the river. And this is Thomas, the Bishop of Becker, and our company's priest. We weren't aware the Earl had a sheriff here in Falmouth, or we'd have come to visit you and announced ourselves." It still feels funny to name Thomas as a bishop, but we bought our titles fairly with our prize money, and there you are.
"Oh, no bother. No bother at all. I'm new here myself, aren't I? Me and my wife don't even have a proper place for you to know about. Just an old hovel in the town is all."
10 minutes of friendly conversation, and it became obvious that Sir Percy was a harmless old soul, who was grateful for the excitement of our arrival, and anxious to hear stories about our adventures crusading with King Richard in the Holy Land. Percy's man Otto, I wasn't too sure about. He looked us over carefully and listened intently whilst I gave a very general description of where we've been and a fairly lame explanation as to why we're here. Our archers are from all over England, so we probably should have continued on to London, it being in the middle of things, so to speak. But Falmouth is the closest port to Lord Edmund's fief at Bosinney, and we promised him we'd look after his wife if he fell. Sir Percy beamed his approval.
"It's good men you are for keeping your word to Lord Edmund. His widow and children will appreciate it, poor things. I don't know him, of course, since I'm newly arrived, but everything I've heard about him has been good."
Then we talked about many things in an effort to get to know one another. Falmouth and the local community, Percy's years of war in France, and our plans to stay over the winter, and what we might do to recruit men to take back to the Holy Land with us, to help us rescue more refugees. Sir Percy smiled and nodded his head enthusiastically when I said we hoped to go back to rescue more people from the Saracens in the spring. What we didn't tell the old fellow is the real reason we are intent on going back to the Holy Land to rescue people from the Saracens, to earn their coins and jewels. What we've learnt is people with coins are willing to pay them to us to carry them to safety when they think the Saracens will kill them or take them as slaves if they don't escape. Similarly willing to pay us are the merchants and pilgrims who want to travel in war galleys, which the Moorish pirates are not likely to attack. We were also very careful not to mention anything to our amiable visitor about our plans for young George, or our intention to establish a permanent base of some kind in Cornwall. And no one, not even Sir Percy, in any way even hinted as to whether he supported Richard or John in the argument which seems to be raging as to whether or not John should remain on the throne if Richard is still alive. All the sheriff and his man knew, when they finally rode away to friendly smiles and waves, is that we were what's left of a crusading company of English archers, and a bishop forced from his flock by the Saracens, and we intend to stay here for a while before we return to the Holy Land to carry more refugees and pilgrims to safety. What they also didn't learn was anything about our humble origins, or the questionable titles we bought in Cyprus, or our plans for my son George. They don't even know Thomas is my brother, which is a secret we decided to keep until we get a better lay of the land, and know how the local earl and his knights will react to our being here. But at least the sheriff knows enough to speak the bastardized Norman dialect of Somerset and Kent people are starting to call English. The people in Falmouth Village and hereabouts speak a local dialect we can hardly understand. Ah, well, back to business, Thomas sighed. What about pulling the galleys out of the water over there between the trees? The ground looks solid, and it's level enough with a bit of a slope, so the rain and piss waters will run off. We could put the men's tents and hovels over there by the trees.
Aye, you could be right, Thomas. You could be right.
Samuel, the sun has just come up. The wind is from the east out of the sun, and you are rowing into the wind. You have only 30 experienced archers and 10 sailors on your galley, because you are out with a skeleton crew to pick up refugees. Your lookout on the mast has just reported seeing 2 Tunisian war galleys dead ahead of you, and they are turning towards you. What orders do you give?
Harold is the master sergeant of our sailors, and that's the kind of question he and Thomas and I have been asking all of our sergeant captains for the past 3 days. Prior to selecting sergeants to captain the 6 galleys, we'll soon be sending back to the Holy Land and other destinations to carry refugees and other coin-paying passengers and cargoes. What we were doing is talking with all our sergeant captains at the same time about what a sergeant captain should do when various events happen. It was something Thomas suggested. He said such make-believe talk was quite helpful for him when he was at the monastery being learnt how to act like a priest. I didn't think much of the idea, but went along with it because Thomas is so well educated, what with his memorizing some of the Bible and reading all 9 books at the monastery. He did it, of course, before he left the monastery to rescue me and take me crusading with King Richard's company of archers. Now, after listening to Thomas for a while, I can most honestly say the make-believe talking for our galley sergeants has been interesting and helpful, at least for me. Hopefully it has been for our sergeant captains as well. What we've been doing for the past 3 days is confronting all of our sergeant captains with different situations and asking what orders they would give and what they would expect their men and their galley to do after they give them. Their first answers, as you might imagine, ranged from quite the right thing to do under the circumstances to damn foolish. Particularly from those who are new sergeant captains, as a result of successfully taking a prize out of Tunis and sergeanting it to Cornwall. Then everyone talked about their answers, until they all understood the best orders to give under the circumstances, and why they should be given. At least we hope they all understand what they should do and say, and remember to act accordingly when the time comes. When we finished talking with the sergeant captains and listening to their answers, Thomas and Harold and I selected the sergeants whose galleys are to sail back to Cyprus and the Holy Land before the storm season arrives, and then began wondering how many of our galleys and which of our men we'd never see again. In a couple of days, six of our galleys would begin sailing and rowing their way back to Cyprus and the Holy Land, along the same basic route we followed to get here a couple of weeks ago. Not all of the galleys and cogs we brought to England a few days ago are going back. One of the galleys has already left for London, with three of the surviving original archers who wanted to go home. A dozen or so of the English galley slaves we freed, and miscellaneous sailors and soldiers and refugees. They were mostly men who originally came from London or thereabouts, and wanted to try to walk to their old homes from there. After the men had dropped off, the galley sergeant captain would try to buy some sacks of corn we can grind for flour and use to brew our ale. He'll use the coins we gave him to buy them at the big market for merchants, selling corn near London's Long Quay. We know he can find them there because I myself helped carry sacks of corn from that very market to the cog that carried us to Cyprus when I was a young lad and our company of archers went crusading with King Richard. There were 192 of us then. Now we are only 10 here in England, and another 7 still in the east for one reason or another. Mostly they're with Urim on Cyprus. Another galley and both of our cogs will soon be following the London galley and go east and west to make more stops at the smaller ports along both coasts. They'll be going all the way to Newcastle and Blackpool, with stops in the smaller ports along the way to land recruiting parties and buy supplies, in addition to dropping off a couple of returning archers and various others. Before our galleys and cogs can sail from here, however, we'll have to unload the coin chests they're carrying, and that means finding a place where we can safely store their cargoes and pull some of our galleys out of the water. Those galleys we pull out of the water will be laid up for the winter because we don't have enough men to crew them, because of desertions as we returned from the Holy Land and our honouring of our promise to discharge the men who want to go home, and also because almost 500 of our best fighting men will be staying with us to guard our boats and coins and other valuables. Also staying with us in Cornwall will be the 200 or so likely-looking recruits we picked up along the way and have begun training as apprentice archers. It's a long process to train archers to use a longbow, isn't it? They need to develop strong arms and learn how to use their bows and care for them. And our archers need even more training than most, because we'll be using them on both land and sea. Surprisingly enough, at least to me, most of the hundreds of galley slaves we acquired and freed when we cut the galleys out of Tunis, including more than half the Englishmen, have volunteered to stay on with us as sailors and make the return trip to Cyprus and the Holy Land. Some probably to get closer to home before they run, but many, it seems, don't have anywhere to go and don't know what else to do. Poor sots. Most of the former slaves who are still with us are lost souls who don't have any idea what to do with themselves. A couple of dozen made their marks to train as archer apprentices, and others are still here because they are going to head towards their homes on the galleys and cogs heading for Newcastle and Blackpool, with stops along the way. We expect some of the archers and slaves to come back. People die in the villages and things change, so it's hard to go home after being away for years. Thomas and I are good examples of why it's hard to go home. There's nothing in the village for us, and I'll be damned and dead before I'll return to being a serf for whoever is the local lord these days. Most of our galleys heading for Cyprus and the Holy Land in the next few days will be gone until about this time next year, if not longer. And that's if they're lucky and don't get taken by the Moors or go down in a storm along the way. And yes, damn it, I made a mistake. We should have sent most or all of the prize galleys back to Cyprus as soon as we took them off the Moors and got them to Malta. In any event, if things go as we hope, over the winter we'll be training up more longbow archers and recruiting experienced pilots and sailor sergeants here in England. If we're successful, we'll be able to send the rest of our galleys out to the Holy Land next year with full crews. It is experienced sea pilots and longbow archers we need most of all. And after them, strong young men we can train to be archers, particularly Englishmen and other islanders, since we need men we can trust. Sailors and men who know how to use a sword are not such a big problem. If necessary, we can recruit them along the way, as we've done in the past. At least, that's our current plan. Accordingly, the galleys and cogs going to Newcastle and Blackpool will put recruiting parties ashore at various ports along the way, and then pick them and their recruits up on the way back. At least, that's the plan until I change it. There's a lot of shipping and sailormen on the Thames below London, so all of our boats going north past the Thames will call in there for a visit, and try to recruit in London and the various ports and quays and wharves serving it. In addition to sailors who are also pilots and who've made multiple visits to the Holy Land and have extensive experience as the sergeants of sailors, our recruiting parties would be particularly looking for experienced longbowmen and likely young men we can apprentice to be archers, but only if they are willing to make their marks on our company's roll to serve in the East aboard our galleys and cogs. Also, at Thomas's request, our recruiting sergeants have been told to keep an eye out and pass the word to let the priests and merchants know we are looking for lively young boys who might be learnt to scribe and do sums and such. Thomas wants them for the school he intends to establish for my son to attend, so George can be learnt to jabber Latin and scribe and sum. The sergeant captains of the cogs and galleys being used for recruiting and supply purposes, and the sergeants in charge of the recruiting parties, don't know it, of course, but they are being tested. Each will be given a goodly sum of silver coins he can use to buy the tents and clothes we need, and to hire fishing boats and passages for any additional recruits and supplies, if the boat he is sergeanting turns out not to be large enough to carry everything. They'll also each be taking one of the paste chests to show to the merchants they meet. We want to know what the value of the paste might be, and who might buy it, and who among our sergeants is capable of dealing with the merchants. Hopefully the boat sergeant captains and the recruiting sergeants will use the coins well and get results and we can promote them. If not, at least we'll know they're not up to bigger things. Our biggest need of all, however, is not likely to be filled, for dependable men who can scribe and do sums and thus are capable of being sergeants captaining major outposts, such as Urim and Randolph are captaining for us in Cyprus and Alexandria. The chance of recruiting such men is slim to none. Thomas is probably right when he says we'll have to find likely young boys like George and train them from scratch as apprentices, if we are to continue to grow a powerful company for George to captain when we're too old to sail and fight. Anyhow, growing our own sergeants is what Thomas wants to do, and that's why we're looking for likely young lads who can be learnt and brought along with young George. Thomas thinks he's already found two such boys in Falmouth. What we're hoping is in the years before George and Thomas's boys are ready to take over, we'll be able to find dependable sergeants who can be joined with scriveners who already know how to read and do sums. In the meantime, we have decided to send some of the prize galleys with little more than skeleton crews back to Cyprus for Urim to send on to the Holy Land ports to haul refugees and pilgrims, and keep 600 or so of our current strength in Cornwall in order to protect our coins. Well, it's 600 if we include the 140 or so men who will be sailing in our cogs and recruiting galleys, and the 200 or so apprentice archers we recruited in the East and brought back to be learnt to push arrows from a longbow. Every one of the galleys heading to Cyprus and onto the Holy Land is a prize galley we took out of Tunis, and every sergeant captaining it, except one, is the original sergeant of its prize crew. Each of them will sail with the smallest possible crew of sailors and fighting men, so their galley can sail between Cyprus and the Holy Land ports with as many refugees in their coins as its sergeant captain can squeeze in. Except for the one man Harold removed for gross incompetence, the sergeant captains will be the prize sergeants who got their galleys to England. they were all given the opportunity to keep their commands, and they all chose to do so. And in virtually every case, were astonished to find themselves elevated above the status in which they'd expected to spend their entire lives. Thomas and I certainly know the feeling. The prize sergeants were selected before we visited Tunis from the archers already serving with us. They got their prizes all the way to England, so we're giving them a chance to keep them as their sergeant captains. Truth be told, we don't have an alternative. Where we've made some changes are in the galley's pilots and in the sergeants of their sailors. There seem to be some good sailormen, including a number of former cog owners and boat sergeants among the slaves we freed when we took the heathen galleys. Some of the best of them will soon be on their way to Cyprus and the Holy Land. Others were keeping with us in Cornwall to crew the galleys, which we will be temporarily pulling ashore to safeguard them. Two, however, will be left afloat and moored in the river, pointed downstream, with our coin chests in their holds, so we can get away in a hurry if we have to run. Each of our six sergeants heading for the Holy Land, as the sergeant captain of a galley, is authorised to maintain his crew by signing up replacement archers, other fighting men if they need additional rowers, and sailors in the ports they visit along the way. They are not, however, to recruit more men than they need for replacements, except for experienced archers, and particularly longbow men, who are to be recruited whenever they can be found, no matter where they come from or how many are available. It was explained over and over again in the make-believe talking meetings why the galley captains are to keep their crews small, so as to allow for the largest possible numbers of coin-paying refugees, pilgrims, and merchants. The make-believe talking is Thomas's idea, and it absolutely amazes the men. They, like me, had never heard of such a thing. But they took to it with surprising enthusiasm, and all of them claimed to have learned a lot. I certainly did whilst I was helping Harold and Thomas put the learning on them, about what to do under various circumstances. A big part of our problem will be to keep the sergeants honest when there are so many coins involved. That's why all the passengers the galleys pick up in the Holy Land ports will be delivered to Cyprus and interviewed by Urim on the Cyprus Quay as soon as they arrive. As you might imagine, the big question every passenger will be asked privately as soon as he steps on the quay is how much he actually paid for his passage, and it better be what each of our sergeant captains turns over to Urim. The passengers will be interviewed and checked off when they arrive, and corrupt sergeant captains and any of their sergeants and crewmen involved will be immediately killed on the spot or discharged. At least, that's what we told the sergeant captains and their sergeants, and that's what appears in the instruction parchments the galleys are carrying to Urim and Randolph. The sergeants better believe it, for Randolph and Urim have indeed been ordered to immediately kill anyone who holds out on us. Thomas. I rode out of camp wearing the gown and mitre I took off the bishop I killed in Latica. I'm off to find Lord Edmund's widow and give her the sad news of Edmund's death, although I'm certainly not going to tell her it was a soldier's mercy from William, because Edmund was so grievously wounded and pained. William is going to stay behind in Falmouth with Harold and George. Whilst I'm gone, William and Harold will organise our men for the winter, since it looks like we'll be staying right here in Cornwall. And that means training them for land warfare, using horsebowmen in the Saracen style, and the long-handled bladed pikes our smith started making for us before we left Cyprus. William and Harold are also going to begin a week or more of training and role-playing for the captains of our cogs and galleys and their sergeants. Harold has more than proved his worth. He's still the sergeant captain of our best galley, but he's also now the master sergeant in charge of all of our galleys and cogs. About a dozen of our steadiest archers and sword fighters travelled with me to visit Edmund's wife at his fief in Bassini. Three of our four horses we were able to buy in Falmouth carried our tents and supplies. I rode the fourth. They were all farm horses, but better than having none. I was in no hurry, and the men were walking, so we made slow time. It took 3 days on a rough and meandering cart path before Edmund's isolated little Bassini castle came into view. It only rained one...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?